They say behind every good man is a good woman. And there's a lot of truth to that. Us men and guys and gentlemen who are married or have been married know that a lot of the times the success that we might have, the good things we might do, are because we have a wife that's pushing us to do a good job. It's pushing us to work hard. That's reminding us of things that we might sometimes forget. It is such a blessing to have what we, you know, we jokingly sometimes say the better half, and in so many ways it's true, but to have what the Bible calls that helpmeet is truly a blessing. You know, I was thinking about in nearly the 8 months now that I've been blessed to be with you, I don't know that I've done a lesson on marriage, at least not to the full crowd. We've talked about it in the ladies' class some, but tonight, I don't want to talk about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, although I'd like to one day in the future, Lord willing. Tonight, I want to talk about the very fundamentals of marriage, what it means to be a husband and what it means to be a wife, and what our roles are to one another. Thinking about the wife and behind every good man is that wife, it reminds me of the story about the man who he was with his wife. They'd been married for over 10 years, and they pulled in at the gas station to get some gas, and he had to stretch his legs, and so he asked his wife to pump the gas for him. And so he gets out and takes a walk, and when he gets back, he notices that she's talking to someone across the way there. It ends up being the gas attendant that's standing out beside their vehicle, and he gets in the car and waits on them to finish up. And as she gets in, he hears the man say, it was good to see you again. And so he asks his wife as she gets in the car, who was that? And she explains that he was someone that she dated in high school. They dated for a while, and they were just catching up a bit, you know. And he says this to his wife. He says, you know, you're very lucky. You're lucky you ended up with me and not him, because if you married him, you would have married a gas attendant. But see, I'm the CEO of my company. And she said, no, honey, you've got it all wrong. She said, if I married him, he would be the CEO of the company and you would be the gas attendant. There's a lot of truth to that. A lot of truth to that. It's truly, truly the case that these women are so good to us and we're blessed to have them. And thinking about these women and how blessed we are to have them, I want to go to 1 Peter chapter 3. Because we could go to Ephesians 5 and we'll reference it a few times. But for this lesson, I thought it would be a different perspective to use 1 Peter 3. Because even though both the wife and husband are discussed and both of their roles addressed, it's all really from the perspective of the wife. And the importance of her, not only what she should be as a wife, but what she needs and what God has instilled within her to desire from her spouse, from her husband. And in this study, we'll see, of course, both sides. We're going to start where Peter starts, though, with the wives. 1 Peter 3, begin with me in verse 1. Young people who are not married, and teenagers and young adults, I want you to be thinking about what to look for and what you are to be one day. For those of us who are married, of course, to begin to put these things in practice if we're not already. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 and 2 beginning. Likewise, ye wives. The word likewise references the fact that he's addressing something or comparing this with what he had previously stated. In 1 Peter 2, he had begun to talk about the servant and master relationship and that concept of subjection, submission. And so he says, likewise, right? And by the way, we might better compare that to an employer and an employee relationship, a boss and the worker. We don't have slavery and masters and servants in that sense, but we can understand it in the light of our jobs. And so he says, in that same sense that you are submissive or in subjection, he says, likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. He talks about, number one, the behavior of the wife. And I say behavior, the word in the King James Version there in verse 2 is conversation. But literally what that word means is your conduct, your behavior. In other words, your behavior should be that which should suggest two words. Number one, in verse 1, subjection. And number 2, in verse 2, fear. Or a better word there would be respect. Or reverence. But I want to look at this idea of subjection for just a minute, verse 1. The word there for subjection in the original language is a military term. And it gives the idea of fully putting yourself in someone else's hands. You are just like the master and servant idea. You're completely submitting your will to to that person, to that leader. And so when you compare this to Ephesians 5, there he calls it submitting to your husband as you would the Lord, as you would submit to Jesus Christ. That's pretty strong language. In what case would you ever not submit to Jesus? And so this is a difficult thing, I would think, for women. Because men, it's easy for us. We've got instilled within us as men this desire to have respect and to be a leader. That's who we are. But naturally, women would have that same feeling. And in today's society, we think about how we're raised, how women are raised, and what we see in the mainstream media and all of these things. It's very very common that women are raised to be an equal leader, or even wear the pants, as we sometimes joke, in the house. I can't help but think of a Disney show, Good Luck Charlie, that has been very popular for a while. I've seen a few episodes, very funny show, and it seems to be fairly clean. But if you pay attention to that, the mom wears the pants. She is the head of that house. And it's, you know, they use it as humor, but it's sad because that's the reality of the way it is in a lot of the homes. Mom is the one that is making the decision. She's the one that the husband just kind of leans on, and she takes control, and she's the disciplinarian and all of these things. But that's not the way it ought to be. So how is it and why is it that a wife is supposed to just submit herself fully to this other individual? And if I may make a parenthetical note here, young ladies, this is why it's so important that you find a man who will spiritually lead you, because you've got to submit to him. But if you notice here in verse 1, he's actually talking specifically to these women who are not married to Christians. It doesn't matter if you're married to a Christian or not. At the end of the day, the same rule applies. You must submit to his will, as long as he's not asking you to do something, of course, contrary to the will of God. Acts 5 and verse 29, we ought to obey God, of course, rather than men. And so why would you do that? You know, some say maybe the wife would naturally want to subject to him because he is physically stronger. And so it just makes sense that he would be the more powerful of the two. And I don't know that's really the case of the matter. I think this is one of those things, and I'm not a woman, I'm not a wife, but I know that women sometimes struggle with this idea, especially, again, in today's society. And so this is one of those things where faith comes into the picture. When we do it because God says to do it. I really feel like that's the case here. Faith is sometimes viewed, I think, as praying to God and believing that He's going to give you everything that you need. And while that may be part of it, that's not really the core of biblical faith. Biblical faith is, I trust His will for my life. And so whatever He asks me to do, I trust that that is what's best, and I do that willingly. And so in this case, wives, women, you are willing, hopefully, to submit because you have faith that God knows what He's talking about. When He says that this is how to have a successful marriage, this is how it's going to work best, is for you to submit yourself to Him. If He's not a Christian, then hopefully you'll win Him over with your good submission and respect for Him. If He is a child of God, then you're going to keep Him very happy in the fact that you're going to reverence Him. That's something that men need. And don't worry, ladies, we're going to flip the coin in a minute. But men are programmed, and keep in mind, there are exceptions to all of these. But for the most part, men are programmed to need that reverence and respect. In fact, that's what he's getting at there in verse 2, when he talks about your chaste conversation, your chaste behavior, your Christian life, your Christian walk, coupled with phobos, phobia, coupled with fear. We use that word phobia in a way that he's not using it here. What he means is respect, reverence. It's so interesting to me that in Ephesians 5 verse 33, he says husbands are to love the wives and wives are to reverence the husband. He doesn't say a husband love your wives and wives love your husbands. We know that's true. Titus 2 and verse 4, wives are to love the husbands. But when he's addressing it there, he says, you love her and she respect him. Because God understands, the Spirit understands, that's how we're programmed. We need to feel respected. Right? I joke about this a lot, and I'll do it again tonight. I'm not the manliest man on the planet. And what I mean by that is, I'm not, you know, I probably would lose an arm wrestling match to most of the women in here. I mean, let's be honest. I'm not a guy that goes and lifts weights and is big and buff. And you know, some guys feel manly in that sense. That's okay. And that is very manly. I wish that I had big muscles like that, but I don't. Right? Some guys are Mr. Fix-It. They can fix anything. And that's a very manly trait. And unfortunately, I'm just not a Mr. Fix-It either. But I still, as a man, want to be respected. I don't want to be talked down to by anyone, but definitely not my wife. That's just something that's natural. Women, there's a way to disagree with a man that is respectful to him. You know, it's one thing to say, fine, whatever. You're the man and you get to decide and storm off. That's not respectful to him. It's not respectful to God. You're not going to get anywhere and not do anybody any good by acting like that. But if you disagree and you discuss it, and at the end of that, maybe you don't agree. Maybe you think that his logic is flawed. But if that's the decision he's made, then you've got to trust that and say, you know what, honey, I may not completely understand or agree, but I'm going to support you in this decision. Right? There's a way to be respectful and help him to feel like that he is the man. You know, there's a lot of good books on marriage, and we could go around the room and everybody suggests books, and at the end of the day, this, of course, is the best one. But a lot of these books will illustrate things very well from the Bible. And one of them that I am very fond of is called the Five Love Languages is the name of the book. And I'm not going to go through all that book with you, but one of the things he points out is that there's five different languages that husbands and wives have. And he basically categorizes them as words of affirmation, physical touch, gifts, acts of service, and quality time. And most of the time, again, there are exceptions, but most of the time, speaking to men right now, in relation to the wife, guys are in the category of the words of affirmation. Usually, they score pretty high in that. Because words are very critical for respect. The way you talk to him, the way that you react to what he says to you, body language, all of those things are in connection to that. And so it's disrespecting him is to say, I don't really, really love you. That, because that's his love language, if that makes sense. It's important to him, and that's why God demands that wives respect the husband and submit to him, because that's how he's designed them. Let's keep going, though. I could spend all day on that. Look at verse number 3 and verse number 4. The beauty aspect of this. Beautiful two passages. Verse 3. Whose adorning? Let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and of wearing of gold or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. First of all, I want you to notice, some would say that this suggests we don't need, our wives don't need to be wearing any jewelry whatsoever, any makeup, any of that stuff. Adorning yourself is ungodly because of verses 3 and 4. I don't think that's what he's saying here. I don't believe he's outright saying you just don't need to take care of yourselves physically at all. Number one, because if you look at this carefully, the end of verse 3, he says putting on of apparel. If we're suggesting that Peter's saying here don't do it at all, then Peter's saying don't put any clothes on. And we know, why are you laughing at that? We know that that's not the case. We know that that's not the case. And we're thankful that that's not the case, right? But he's saying here the principle is not to focus on the outward so much as you're focusing on the inward. Not even that it's 50-50. The primary is there's little profit, of course, to taking care of the body. And I think in the second place, it's disrespectful on both sides to not take care of yourself for your spouse. Husbands, we ought to practice personal hygiene and take care of ourselves for our wives. They'll appreciate that. I think that's important. And wives ought to take care of themselves and their bodies and that sort of thing for their husband. Nothing wrong with that. But when we live in a society, and we do, that cares so much more about the outward than the inward, we're doing it wrong. I was noticing that there are some different surveys that have been done by these popular magazines. Glamour, for example, did a survey of a whopping 33,000 women. And by the end of that survey, they found that the number one, by far, the number one goal of women in America is to lose 10 to 15 pounds. That's the most important goal. It was, and the biggest fear of women in America, by far, was to gain too much weight. And they feared that more than their parents dying or a nuclear holocaust. Seriously, based on this survey now, that's incredible. It also showed that 1 in 4 college girls have an eating disorder. Anorexia and all the staggering numbers connected to that. We live in a society that's all about how many pounds I gained this week or how many pounds I lost this week. And again, to some degree that's okay, but when we care more about that than we do the inward beauty, women, we're missing the point. Your husband, just like me, probably doesn't know a whole lot about the details of the jewelry that you wear or the brands of the clothes that you have on. It's amazing. Women will spend so much time changing clothes. We just go put some jeans on or whatever and we're ready to go. But women, you know, they think about... But see, what men will notice, and that is more important than that, is a woman that cares more about the outward than the inward. A woman who's more interested in how she looks than how she behaves in the home. That's when it becomes a problem. Did you notice, I love this passage, and I know it sounds like I'm joking when I say this, but I'm not. This is a biblical principle, verse 4. He says, notice there, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit. Meek, that strength under control, and quiet, peaceable. I think Peter knew exactly what he was talking about by inspiration when he said that women need to really pay attention to their spirit in the home. Because, you know, and again, we joke about this, but it's very serious. You know, if we often say, if mama's not happy, nobody's happy, right? But there's a lot of truth to that because the wife sets the emotional tone for the home. And so when mama's happy, everybody's happy, and when she's not, because that's how she's programmed. Women are very different than men in their emotion and how that they show that and how they reveal that. And it's just who we are. And so Peter says women need to practice that meek and quiet spirit. That's inner beauty, he says. That's important because you're setting that emotional standard the atmosphere for that home. And that's not to be harsh. That's just the principle there behind it. He says, which is in the sight of God of great price. Proverbs 31 and verse 10, the virtuous woman, he says her price is far above rubies. Such a valuable and rare thing to find a woman that's more concerned about the inner person than the outer. What a blessing that is. And that's what a godly wife should focus on, the inner. We get to verses 5 and 6. For after this manner, in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are as long as ye do well and are not afraid with any amazement. We think about the background, and I use that term for this reason. He's basically saying here, he's holding Sarah up, if you will, and saying, women, wives, you can be like Sarah. You can be the daughter of Sarah in a symbolic sense, and that you can call him Lord. Now, husbands, don't get excited. I'm not trying to tell your wife that she needs to call you Lord around the house, but there's a principle behind that. Now, she did. Genesis 18 and verse 12, you see her reference, my Lord, being old also, in reference to her having a child and that disbelief there. But there's a principle in that Sarah was submissive to Abraham. She made mistakes, but she's well known for the fact that she was submissive. Otherwise, Peter wouldn't say this here. And so, the question I would ask is, you as a wife, are you a daughter of Sarah in that sense? Are you like her in subjection to your husband? What would he say? Who would he say that you're a daughter of in the Bible? Would he say, and I don't mean this as a joking way, seriously, would he say that you're more like a daughter of Jezebel? You remember Jezebel, Ahab's wife, that she was... she was wicked, and she pulled him away from God and toward idolatry, right? Are you a wife that's more like Jezebel, and that you're pulling him away from the truth, and he's trying to lead you, and you're being stubborn spiritually speaking? You're focusing on material things or the idols of this world? Maybe you're like Job's wife. I hope this is not the case, and I certainly don't think it is, but you think about Job's wife. When things got awful and bad, and he needed that support, he needed her to comfort him and to encourage him. Instead, she says, and apparently she had decided that what they were doing was worse than hell, I guess, because her reaction is, you just need to curse God and die. That's what she said to him. Are we a daughter of Job's wife in that sense? Or maybe we're a daughter of Priscilla. We've been talking about Aquila and Priscilla in our Bible class. Her hospitality, the church meeting in their home, and her studying and teaching others, and her good example. And what is your background? Who are you most like, ladies, in the Bible? I love that he mentions there that you can be like Sarah, a daughter of Sarah in that sense. The wife is 50% of the relationship, of course, is so critical. And her mindset and her reverence to her husband and her subjection to him and submission is all part of God's design of marriage. And if it's done the way God would have it to be done, then a lot of problems are going to be resolved in that marriage because we're doing it God's way. A lot of the times, let's be honest, the reason we have issues is because we fail to do it God's way. Now, let's flip the coin. Let's pick on the men here for just a minute as well. He gets to verse 7. It's interesting again to me. There's six passages focused on the women. And verse 7 still is focused on the women, but it changes perspectives. Look at verse 7. It's about what women want, but he's talking about the role of the husband. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge. I want to pause right there for a minute. There's a whole lot, I believe, that goes into that one statement. Dwell with her according to knowledge. Again, sometimes we joke about this, but it's a biblical principle. Because the fact is, women understand men a lot better than we understand women. We're very transparent as guys, and I think that's pretty normal in most cases. There's a lot of things men just don't get about women. And so it's very significant to me that Peter says, dwell with them according to knowledge. In other words, husbands, we need to be doing our best to learn her, to understand her and what her needs are, and how to fulfill those needs. I'm going to reference back for just a moment to the five love languages. In most cases, in my experience, I've had the opportunity to do some of this, the test that comes with that book, and talk with several different couples about this. And it seems to me that most of the time, women seem to fall into the category of either quality time or physical touch, one of those two. And basically, the idea behind that is in order for your wife to feel loved, she speaks the language of probably quality time and or physical touch in most cases. We would call that affection. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But on that note, we as guys, let's say your love language is words of affirmation, and that's what mine is, I'll be honest with you. We might say to her every day, I love you. And when she says that to us, that means something because we care about words. Right? I love you and you did a great job on the yard, or you are Mr. Fix-It, or man, your muscles are big, or whatever it is she says that makes you feel good. I don't hear that one, but no, whatever she says that makes you, that's words of affirmation. And that says to you, I love you, sweetie. I love you. That's what that means. But you might say that to her, but that's not her language. And you neglect the quality time and you neglect the physical touch of the relationship. And you can say all day that you love her, but guess what? She goes to bed at night empty because she's not getting that love language. That's a biblical principle here. Dwell with her according to knowledge. Learn what her needs are and feel those needs. One other point about this, an illustration that really stuck with me that maybe will help you as well as husbands. There is a tank, and you husbands know this. And most of you have been married a lot longer than me and know this better than I do, but maybe you haven't thought about it this way. But there is a tank that a women have. It's, you know, we might call it the love tank. And that tank is going to be, when you wake up in the morning, that tank may be on empty, it may be on half. But as we don't fulfill the needs of our wives, right, in showing that we love her, that tank begins to empty. And what happens when that tank begins to empty is she may be more tempted to not act the way that you would want her to act. She might be more tempted to say things that aren't encouraging, to not give you those words of affirmation or whatever your love language might be, and to be more disrespectful. Not that that's okay, but she's her tank's getting empty, and so she needs that feeling of being loved, and so she's sad, and so we fulfill those needs and we fill that tank up, and our marriage is wonderful. That's a biblical principle. Dwell with her according to knowledge. There's another book that's out that some of you, I haven't read this one, but I've heard a lot about it. It's very popular. It's called His Needs, Her Needs. And Dr. William Harley, I believe is his name, that wrote this, a very, very popular book. And he says that there are five things. I'm just going to mention three of them and put this with the Bible, of course. But he says there are three things that every woman needs. Every woman needs these three things. He says five. I'm going to say three of them. The first three he mentions. And I believe there's a lot of truth to this biblically. The first one is what I've kind of been talking about here, affection. Affection. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3. I want you to turn over there with me. We'll come back to 1 Peter, but 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3. You see, we understand that as a husband, you know, Ephesians, Paul tells us, chapter 5, 25, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. We understand that we're to do that, but where we sometimes fail, I think, men, and myself included, very much so, is that we fail in showing that love. That's what I'm talking about. We fail in showing her because we don't love her based upon knowledge. We just love her the only way that we may know how, and that may be by words or something else. But in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 3, he says, "Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband." The word benevolence there is this word that means affection. He says, you dwell with her and give her her due affection. She needs, wives need, women need to feel that support. We know that. They need that support. They need that protection. And so the way in which we show them that we love them, hopefully the way that they want it to be done, the way they speak love, right? Some women speak love, T-I-M-E. Some women might spell love, T-O-U-C-H, or something else. Maybe it's gifts. Maybe it's acts of service. Maybe it's something else that I've not mentioned. But whatever that is, there is a due affection that she needs. And if she's not getting that affection, then mama's not going to be happy, right? The wife's not going to be pleased. She might do her best to try to be, but there's a role that a husband has to play in that, in giving her that support. Part of that comes into this second one, which I really believe is so, so important, and that is communication. Communication. Not always, but most of the time, when there's a problem with communication, it's on the side of the men. The error is on the side of the men. Women are usually much more ready to talk and sit down and have some quality conversation than men are. Not always, but probably most of the time. I love Song of Solomon. That whole book, we could do a whole series, and I better be careful about saying that, but we could do a whole series on Song of Solomon in talking about marriage and the great lessons from that. But in Song of Solomon 2 and verse 14, she mentions about her upcoming husband, her groom, that his voice is amazing. His voice is so sweet, I believe it's how it's worded, and that she loves his voice and his comeliness, his appearance as well. She loves to hear his voice. You know, Amber and I, we've never really talked about it, but I guess it's an unspoken rule that we will never go a day, if we can help it, without talking to one another. And I think probably most of you that are married are in the same boat there. Sometimes we're apart. Yeah, I've been to like Bible camps in the summer, and I'm gone for a week, and I'm without her during that week or whatever it might be. Maybe it's a meeting that she couldn't go to or whatever. But when we're apart, we talk to each other every day, and we have an interest, right? You want to know how her day went. She wants to know how your day went, and you talk about it. And so that's important. But more than that, there is an important time every day that needs to take place in which you have that good quality communication. Now listen to me, guys, and I'm not trying to act, please don't think, I'm not trying to act like a professional, like I've got all this right, because I'm learning. But I know what to do, I just have trouble doing it. And I'm not trying to give you excuses, husband, but here's what we need to be doing. Let me give you an example. I heard of a gentleman who had what he called the talking chair. And the talking chair was a recliner that was by his bed. And every night, he would sit down for a set amount of time. I believe it was 15 minutes for him. And he would tune everything out. And he would sit down with his wife. He would look her in the eyes. And he would ask her how she's doing. He would just talk to her about her day. He would talk to her about what was on her mind. He would look at her in the eyes. He would listen. He would respond appropriately. Because let's be honest, guys. When I don't know if you're like me, but I think probably most guys are very one-track minded. And when our wives are talking to us and we're watching TV at the same time, that conversation is probably not going to go very well. In fact, if she asks you to do something, if you're like me, you probably didn't even let it sink in. Or she tells you something important and then a week later when the time comes and you realize, what are you talking about? You never mentioned that. Oh, I did. It was when you're watching TV, right? That there's a big difference between quality time, quality conversation, and conversations when everything else is going on around you, all right? When it's just the two of you talking together, that's critical. That's so important to have that relationship. It's just like, it's the same with God. You have that one-on-one time when you go down and it's just you and God and you talk to Him. And that's part of a relationship. And that is that's necessary. It is a necessity, what I was trying to say. And the same is true with the spouse. We need that communication. I've got to keep going. Honesty is the third one he mentioned, and it's so true. Husbands, if you haven't done it already, just make a pact right now that you're going to make things easy for yourself and be honest. Always be honest, because when you break that trust, When there's a time that comes and she cannot trust you, it is going to take a long time to heal that. Trust is so very critical to any relationship. And so honesty is part of that. Proverbs 31 and verse 11, Solomon says, speaking of that virtuous woman, that he safely trusts in her. Certainly, I think the reciprocal of that would be true, that she should be able to trust you and that you should talk to her. Now, I'm not talking about being, she comes up to you and says, do I look fat in this dress, and you're going to be rude or something like that. That's not what I'm talking about. But be honest with her. Always be honest. And that's going to be such a critical part of the relationship. My time is almost up, and I want to make sure to get this in. Back to 1 Peter 3, and the lesson will be yours. 1 Peter 3, and let's finish verse 7. First Peter 3, verse 7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge. Now, he gives three reasons why that is, why this is important. Three reasons. Here we go. He says, giving honor to the wife as unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life, and that your prayers be not hindered. He mentions the wife there as the weaker vessel. It's not that the wife is not valuable. Maybe the best illustration would be, silk is more fragile than denim, but silk is much more valuable and much more beautiful, much, much prettier to look at. Women are the weaker vessel, not in the sense that they're not valuable. Oh, they're very valuable like that silk. But in the sense that they are delicate, that they need security. They need protection. And so you dwell with them according to knowledge, number one, Peter says by inspiration, because she needs that. She needs that security. She needs that protection and that feeling that she can trust you. That you are telling her and showing her through your actions that you do love her. Right? And that you care about her with the time that you spend with her. I've got to keep going. Heirs together of the grace of life is the second one. This is really an interesting one, and I think this is what he's getting at. You know what? We are both, Jesus died for both the husband and the wife. He died for all of us on that cross. But in reference here, he's talking from the perspective of the woman. And I think what Peter's saying here, I really believe, is that Jesus is saying, I died for her. I bought her just as much as he did you. But from the perspective of the wife, I bought her, I purchased her with my own blood, and she is an heir, and she is mine, and I am allowing you to have her. I'm allowing you to spend time with her, and so treat her good. I really think that's the principle behind that statement. You're heirs together of the grace of life because of the fact that God has died for her and how precious that she is to the Lord. She ought to be that precious to you, and you should treat her like she is the value that she is, far above those rubies. Heirs together of the grace of life. And the third reason to dwell with her according to knowledge is that so your prayers are not hindered. You and I both know that when you, and we all have those things that come up that we disagree on. Everybody has those disagreements. It's how you handle them and what happens next that really separates a good marriage and sometimes struggling marriages. But when those times come and you're at that disagreement, and hopefully, I hope that we all pray with our spouses every day at some point, but it's hard to do that, to pray in that, and that not be hindered when you're not in a good moment with one another, when you're not getting along, when there's a wall between you, a barrier. Chances are you're probably not even going to pray because you know that there's a block, there's a hindrance there. And so he says, husbands, you need to do your part to fill her tank so that your prayers are not hindered, so that you're not making her feel empty and not feeling secure and not feeling protected, not giving her that due affection. Because that's going to come in front of and hinder your spiritual time. You know, Paul, in 1 Corinthians 7, I believe is where he mentions it, he says that he would, in the present distress, it's 1 Corinthians 7, 29 and following, he says in the present distress, he said, I would that you don't even get married under the current persecution. Now, he's telling them this, but here's why. He says, because when you're married, you have to care about her. You have things and responsibilities. You've got to focus on her, and she's got to focus on him, right? There's a role that takes place. It's not just an empty word, marriage, and you just happen to be in the same house. right? Their responsibilities. He says, but don't get married, he says, right now if you're not, because that there's more responsibility that needs to be given to the Lord in that current distress. Here's the point. Marriage takes work. It does. And I know at 28 years old, I don't understand that maybe as much as many of you do. We've been married just over 5 years, but I do know that much, that it does take work. And I know that what should be happening as time passes is that marriage gets stronger and stronger, because you learn more about each other. You dwell better according to knowledge every day because you're learning about that person. I heard someone say that an archaeologist is the best husband, because the older the wife gets, the more interested he'll be in her. You know, I like that. That's a, you know, obviously that's a, not a, you know, you don't have to marry an archaeologist, but in that same sense, as you grow and learn each other better, it ought to become, every aspect of that marriage should become better, and it should be happier, not less happy. And so maybe if there's struggles, if there's problems in that home, it's because one or usually both parties are struggling to keep up their part of that role. And so talk about that and work that out together and do a better job, each of us, to fulfill our roles as good, godly spouses, husbands and wives. I hope that in some way this has been of a benefit to you and your family. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, speaking of marriage, you're not married to Christ. That's the most important thing of all. We want to put all the rest of that to the side and make sure that you're married to Christ to begin with. Hey, we can represent how to be married to Christ on our five fingers. We've got the hearing of the gospel. Romans 10 and verse 17. So then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. And then there's that belief. You believe that Jesus is the Son of God. John 8 and verse 24. Then there's the repentance. Acts 17 and verse 30. The mental decision that you're going to turn away from sin and live for Him. And then there's confession. You confess with your mouth that you believe Jesus is the Son of God. Matthew 10, 32. And then you go down into the watery grave of baptism, and you're raised to walk in newness of life, and you're a child of God. That, at that point, Acts 2 and verse 38, all your sins are washed away. You can do that this evening if you've never done that. If you have questions, then let us study that and talk about it with you and help you before it's too late. Maybe you've done those things, but you've not been the spouse that you should be. Maybe there's something else that's going on behind the scenes, and maybe it's private and you want to keep it that way. Maybe it's public and needs to be publicly confessed, or maybe you just want to lean upon your brethren. We're here for you, and we want to do that. If you'll let us know, if you're subject to the invitation and have any need at all, spiritually speaking, won't you come forward right now as we stand and sing together?